Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
It's debt service that's killing all these economies, and it's the nature of our debt-based system, where if all of our money is created by banks, if they create the principal and they don't create the interest, and we have to pay back principal and interest, the only place to get the interest is to take out more debt. So you have this perpetual need to grow, and ultimately the debtors can't take on any more debt, and you hit the wall and the whole thing collapses, and that's what we've seen over and over and over again.
In that simple statement, Ellen Brown describes the core architectural flaw, or the Achilles heel, if you will, of our monetary and financial system, that our affairs are shaped around the need to satisfy an insatiable master, constantly growing private debt. Hello there, I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute. And on today's program, we're going to hear from one of society's most insightful and highly published veteran observers, who takes no intellectual or informational nourishment from mainstream media. Stephen Lenman returns to the program today and draws his own conclusions about what's really happening in the world. A look under the hood to examine how the real-world powers shape news headlines, manipulate our understanding to prop up private interests, and obscures a clear vision of the mechanics of the politics and financial interests that we're obliged to live with. He's one of Ellen's favorite guests, and they'll be talking about the new American administration, the overpowering of civil events and political control by global interests, and the resulting detriment to democratic influence on public policy. This edition of the program will give you a good grounding on what all the fuss about public banks is about. Later on today's program, we'll talk with Donald Cohen, the executive director of In the Public Interest, which is now issuing a very helpful, insightful weekly newsletter about developments in the push for privatization of public assets, an accelerating frontier for investment finance interests anxious to obtain control of public assets, usually at bargain basement prices, which leaves little control and less equity for the government agencies that make Faustian deals with global finance for a few shekels of currency in their pocket. But now, let's visit with Ellen, who just had dinner with someone whose name you're sure to recognize.
So you had an opportunity to spend some time with Senator Elizabeth Warren, and that's interesting because she has been a leader in banking reform over the last several years, even taking stands against her own party, against Obama's administration relative to the TPP and fostering the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. What was your experience of her?
I actually got to sit catty-corner to her at a dinner by the Samuel Lawrence Foundation here in California. And
does she have good manners, good table manners?
Yes. So I got to give my pitch on public banking. There were like eight people at the table, and so we all went around and said what we, you know, were there for or what our particular interest was. And so I told her that I thought we had a bipartisan issue here, that we had supporters for public banking on both sides of the aisle, and that generally, I mean, we have so much divisiveness in the country right now, but what we really need is a unifying issue, and this could do it, that she could be the person who brings the tribes together. Basically, everybody wants, for example, lower health care costs, but we don't know how to fund it. So we need a third alternative, not raising taxes and not slashing services, not privatizing everything. We need to find another way to come up with the money, which public banking does. That now that we know that banks create the money they lend, that banks actually create our entire money supply and rent it back to us, there's no need for these middlemen. We can cut out the middlemen, save 50% on the cost of infrastructure, because interest is half the cost of infrastructure, and that obviously both sides want to fund infrastructure. We want to find a way to cut healthcare costs, et cetera, and this is the way to do it.
What kind of a response did you get to that?
A very good response. I was very pleased, actually. So I told her that we had a quite vibrant public banking movement, the local, state, and we'd like to do federal. I mean, you could also do federal. That we, the people, should actually own the banks at all levels, or they should be operating as public utilities, and that actually the Federal Reserve should be operated as a public utility, doing quantitative easing for the people, basically, like Jeremy Corbyn had recommended, that you could do quantitative easing for education, quantitative easing for, you know, Medicare for all, quantitative easing for basic income guarantee, and for infrastructure. You could use it for all of that, and it would not be inflationary, that it would increase the productivity of the economy, and the money would come back in the form of taxes, et cetera. So I went through that whole pitch, and about the Bank of North Dakota, and she knew the Bank of North Dakota, and of course she had supported postal banking, so she was quite receptive. She said she would read my materials. So she talked for 45 minutes in the beginning about how she became a senator, and she started out as a teacher. She just wanted to be a school teacher.
Well, what does she see on the horizon for any sort of a shift or true reform in banking circles? Or is she just resigned to the behemoth that we are having to deal with?
Well, she's all about regulating the banks, of course, and going back to reinstating Glass-Steagall, breaking up the big banks. But my sense, and it was said over a dinner, you know, can we do that? That's the question. Will there be so much resistance that it's just not going to happen? So if we could come up with a way, I think I mentioned that what we should really do is just own the banks. If we could turn them into public utilities, we can leave them as large institutions serving the people.
Mm-hmm.
My thought, I didn't say it, but when the next time a big bank goes down, instead of bailing it out or bailing in the money of the depositors, which isn't going to work either, as we saw in Europe, what they should do is nationalize it, which is what they talked about it in 2008, nationalizing the banks. But the reason it didn't happen was that they didn't want to take on the liabilities of the big banks, take it onto the government's balance sheet. But it was demonstrated after that, when the Federal Reserve bought all those toxic assets off the books of the banks, you don't need to take it on the government's balance sheet. You can move them onto the central bank's balance sheet, where they don't do any harm. It's the central bank's balance sheet doesn't have to balance. They can just leave those toxic assets there.
Mm-hmm. That's a concept that just doesn't sit right with people. The anxiety around the national debt is ubiquitous. Everybody so concerned about the growing national debt, and yet it's really not the boogeyman that we think it is.
Well, the problem with the debt is the interest. But if you move it onto the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, then they rebate the interest to the government. So it's a wash. It just sits there. Like the first round of quantitative easing, the mortgage-backed securities were bought by the Federal Reserve, and these were the toxic mortgage-backed securities that were preventing the banks from doing more loans. So the Fed said that they actually turned a profit by the time several years down the line. They had actually collected more. It's a long story, but the reason they were toxic in the first place was because they changed the accounting method from mark to fantasy to mark to market. So suddenly these assets that the banks were valuing as worth X suddenly were only worth Y.
Right.
But they actually were worth X. It was that was an accounting maneuver pulled off by the Financial Stability Board in Basel. The Basel II Accords in 2006, I think, which actually is what precipitated the crash of 2008, just as the first Basel Accords precipitated the Japanese bank crash in 1990. There are kind of accounting solutions to all this once you understand how the system works, and that's the key here. Once you understand that banks are creating our money and renting it back to us, we can clearly eliminate the middleman, do it ourselves, save 50% on the cost of infrastructure and other things.
Great strategy, and perhaps that's our own fantasy, but certainly given how well positioned the financial interests are in government.
One other point that I mentioned was that we could restore the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. She had talked about how Roosevelt had, she was defending the Glass-Steagall Act, that people had said that that wouldn't work. And she said, well, it did work for 50 years, that Roosevelt had stepped in and saved the day with the Glass-Steagall Act and other banking reforms. But she didn't mention the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. So I just mentioned that over dinner, that that was another form of bank. I mean, it was a financial institution that was used to rebuild the economy. And they did it with that. It was off balance sheet. It wasn't, it didn't go on the budget. So, and yet they started out with $500 million of capital from the government, and by the time they were done, they had lent $40 billion, and they basically did it by refunneling Treasury money, you know, issuing bonds with the, which the Treasury bought. But because the Treasury was the creditor, not the borrower, it didn't go on the balance sheet of the government.
Right. Was she aware of that?
She nodded. Anyway, you know, I have a whole chapter in it in that book, which I gave her. So with any luck, maybe she'll flip through the table of contents and see that.
Right. Okay. Well, Ellen, thanks for reporting on your dinner with Senator Elizabeth Warren. And she uses all of the utensils in the right order and good table manners.
Oh, yes. You definitely felt the sense of sisterhood. Like, it was just very...
Uh-huh.
I think her best feature is she's just so passionate about things.
The two of you make a good pair, and we'd certainly like to see you work closely together in the future to try to get some changes going on for our own financial interests. So let's proceed with the show and to your conversation with Stephen Lenman. Good talking to you now, and see what happens next.
I'm speaking with Stephen Lenman, a prolific writer and syndicated columnist who hosted a radio show on this network, the Progressive Radio NewsHour, for many years until he had to stop due to health issues. He interviewed me many times in that show and is still very actively writing, and so I like to check in periodically to hear his views on things. So, Steve, it's great to be talking to you.
Oh, Ellen, it's great to be on with you, and when I was actively hosting, you were one of my favorites.
Yeah, you were my favorite. Just fun to talk to. That's why I miss talking to you.
Oh, we've had so many rousing discussions, and yeah, it's great to be able to have another one today.
Oh, cool. I hear you have 4 interviews today, which is, you said.
Oh, indeed, a first for me. I've never had, I think once or twice in the past I had 3 in one day, and today I'll have 4. My goodness, if somebody calls me for another one, I'll just say, egad.
Yeah. Early in my career, I hired a publicist, and she set me up with interviews, and one day I had 6, and by the last one, I had no idea what I was saying. I was just like mindless.
Well, another one of my favorites, Bob Chapman, who put out the International Forecaster, Economic and Financial Policies, former Wall Street guy who became independent on his own, very sadly passed away a number of years ago, and I greatly missed him because he had lots of good information on his site.
Yeah,
and he told me he put out volumes of information twice a week in his Forecaster, and yet he took interviews all day long, one after another. I don't know how he did it.
So we've had lots of things going on in the world, many populist uprisings around the world, largely due to, well, probably all due to financial issues. In other words, people have lost their jobs. They've been squeezed out of the market by the banking crisis that was precipitated by our banks, of course, in 2008-2009. But these uprisings seem to keep getting suppressed in one way or another, or they get turned on their heads. Like, for instance, that I would say the Trump election was a populist. I mean, it was a revolt of the people against established politics, but we seem to be back to where we were. But of course, we have to talk about money on this show. So among your various articles that you've written of late, the one that particularly piqued my interest was called "Greece is No Longer a Sovereign State." You wrote in that Greece has been essentially colonized by Berlin and Brussels. Sort of captured by debt. So I wondered if you could expand on that and tell us the latest developments in the Greek saga. I've written a lot about that too.
I guess the Greek saga, Ellen, began around 1999. I forget the precise dates. I didn't look them up, but with the establishment of the Euro system, where nations surrendered their sovereign. Unbelievable. It's amazing that people in nations would surrender their financial and monetary authority to a higher power abroad. So instead of running their own monetary and fiscal policies, what is it, 17, 18 Euro nations, controlled by Brussels, and I put in Berlin because Germany is the dominant Euro power, and nothing happens in Brussels without Berlin's approval. So it really is a Berlin system, and the headquarters of the Eurozone is in Brussels, same place where NATO was headquartered. It's where the EU is headquartered, and then NATO was headquartered, and the Euro system headquartered in Brussels. It could be anywhere, but it just happens to be there. But again, with Berlin pulling the strings, and behind the scenes, Washington pulling the strings. And again, I mean, the system, I mean, it's incredible that you put dissimilar countries under the same system. Economic powerhouse Germany with basket case Greece. Now, how do you put those two countries together? I mean, Greece, I think, has been a basket case for many years, and then you get entrapped in what I call the Euro straitjacket. They have to obey the system. They don't have to. They could default on their debt. They could get out of the Euro system, but they move from one government to another, and they all go along with the same system, imposing enormous austerity on their own people. The latest example, just in the past few days, last week, there have been many instances of public riots and protests against what's been going on, but they subside, and then things go on, and then there's another debt. There's another tranche of bailout that Greece needs to make payments to bankers, which is what it's all about. Bankers hold enormous amounts of Greek debt, and paying them comes first, regardless of human suffering in the country. So pensions are slashed, I believe, 12 times since austerity began being imposed in 2010. Wages have been cut, taxes on ordinary people raised, other social benefits cut. The healthcare system in Greece is an abomination, where people are not getting the healthcare they need. So the death rate is going up. People are suffering. Illnesses aren't being treated. This is what's going on under the system that requires that bankers be paid first.
Right. I was in Switzerland a month ago, and I talked to some German ladies, and the reason that they stay in the Euro, apparently, of course, they were German, but they painted a very graphic picture of, these were older women, of how bad the war was, World War II, and that they absolutely don't want to get into war with their neighbors again, that it's... And so they're willing to go to these great lengths to try to preserve this union of all the European countries. But, of course, what they did wrong was to unite it monetarily without uniting it democratically, which apparently is thought to be impossible. But it seems to me that the monetary union is impossible, too, and hopefully... It's easy enough for me to say to break it up. Let them default on it. Seems to me that Greeks should default on their debt. I mean, they have to default ultimately, it looks like.
Oh, they absolutely have to.
And establish their own currency.
They really do, because every time they accept another tranche and bailout to pay the bankers a pittance, if it goes to, pay your bureaucrats to keep the country operating. You know, you can't drive a bus without a driver, so you got to pay the bureaucrats. But a lot of them have been let go, so it's a much thinner government operation now. The other big thing going on is Greece selling off its crown jewels, its enterprises and things like. I think the Parthenon will probably be up for sale next. I think it's still a Greek Greek possession, but they'll probably end up selling that off. But selling everything off at fire sale prices to corporate interests in Europe, in America. Anybody wants to buy this stuff, buy it on the cheap. And ordinary people suffering so much. Greece keeps getting more indebted every time they take more money from the euro system, which comes mainly from Germany, I believe. And the money goes to pay off the bankers. They get more indebted, so there's no way in the world that they can end up not at some point in the future defaulting. Why not do it now and get it over with, which is the way it should be? The Argentina solution, which I think you've written about, Ellen, and I did too a long time ago.
Yeah, and then they went to alternative currencies. They set up, the government issued its own currency at the national level, the local level, and the city provincial level. They basically paid with IOUs. But the IOUs were accepted in the payment of taxes, so that made it a trade like a currency, unlike California, which paid in IOUs when it was insolvent. But they wouldn't take the IOUs in payment for taxes, so it's like, we'll pay you with them, but we're not going to accept them back. So that didn't work. Anyway, the currency has to be viable for all purposes if the government's going to issue it. But I saw where the Greeks are, at least in one city, the city of Volos, are issuing a community currency that's thriving. So basically what happens is the people pay their big bills in euros. I mean, you still have to pay your utility bills or your imports or whatever in euros. But then if they're selling goods and services among themselves, they do it in this alternative currency, and that has worked very well. So it keeps the local economy thriving. So that might be the solution.
That could be a solution, absolutely. Under the present system, the way the country is governed, Greece has no control over its monetary policy, so it can't have a Greek central bank print money and finance the things that it needs to do. It has no control over its fiscal policy, so in times of dire economic duress like now, they can't institute fiscal policies to stimulate the economy. They can't do that. They can't devalue their currency to benefit exports. They can't do any of those things. So the only thing they can do is what Germany tells them to do and Brussels tells them to do. So they keep paying the bankers and inflicting enormous harm on their people. And this has been going on since 2010.
Mm-hmm. I saw an article in The Economist that said that there was an argument among the creditors themselves, and that was what was stalling the payment from this ESM, the Exchange Stabilization Fund. The one set were encouraged because, I forget what they called it, but something like the prime economy, anyway, was showing a surplus of 3.5% or something, and they defined prime as not including debt. Well, great, you know, debt service, of course. So if you add in debt service, you're back to below zero. It's debt service that's killing all these economies, and it's the nature of our debt-based system, where if all of our money is created by banks, I always get flack on this debt virus theory, but it just seems to me obviously true, and we're seeing it playing out today, that if all of our money is created by banks, if they create the principal and they don't create the interest, and we have to pay back principal and interest, then the only place to get the interest is to take out more debt. So you have this perpetual need to grow, and ultimately the debtors can't take on any more debt, and you hit the wall and the whole thing collapses, and that's what we've seen over and over and over again. So I suppose it'll collapse again, and the people who have access to money will buy up all the assets at fire sale prices, just as we've seen again and again. Basically, we have two economies, a financialized economy and the real producing economy. And the producing economy has been parasitized to the point that the host is dying. The parasite has killed the host.
And the financialized economy is that giant squid.
Yeah, and they have control of government. I mean, we don't no longer have a democracy, obviously, because whatever the people want doesn't seem to get recognized in the federal government level, not just in Greece, but in the U.S. as well. So the bankers call the shots. They pass the laws. So where any other business that kept going bankrupt would be out of business by now, somehow they manage to get bailed out over and over, and they get all the perks. Like, to save the banks, the Federal Reserve dropped the interest rate for the banks to 0.25%, but not for us. I mean, the banks could still charge us 5%, and they're getting the money for 0.25%. And they don't even use it for loans anymore for small businesses. They're using it to buy stuff. They can use this very cheap interest rate to buy up all the assets globally.
Oh, it's a sure thing. And, of course, after the 2008 financial crisis, they used it to buy up competitors. So the industry, the banking industry, is hugely more concentrated now than it was back then. And for certain, there'll be another crisis coming. What form it'll take, who knows? But there'll be another crisis, and maybe there'll be more consolidation, not just in banking, but in other industries. And we've got a terrible debacle in America and other countries. What's happening in Greece is worst of all in the Western world. But the same thing is happening to a lesser degree in other countries where forced austerity on people, where the great wealth disparity in America and other European countries, this thing just gets more and more extreme. And the budget that Trump will come out with will take this to a greater extreme than already if it's enacted into law. Probably not exactly the way Trump proposes it, but a lot of what he's proposing will be enacted into law so that the rich will get richer and business will make more profits. And ordinary people will take it in the ear. So it's happening here, it's happening in Europe, and Greece is the worst example. But maybe what's going on in Greece is a symbol of what's going to be happening everywhere at some point in the future, where things in America could literally get as bad as Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Except for one thing, Ellen. America isn't beholden to the euro system, so it's got the printing press and it can print all the money at once.
Exactly. And Donald Trump knows that. I've written that several times where he said, you forget, we can print the money. So if he did that, I mean, I think he's been captured by the deep state, too, as they say. It used to be a conspiracy theory to say deep state, but now it's actually in the mainstream media. He's been captured. But if he had the nerve, if he were bold enough, he's pretty bold, but I think they take him into a little room and they show him a picture of the Kennedy assassination or something, and that's the end of that. But if he were bold enough, he could solve all these problems by doing exactly what Abraham Lincoln did, just issue the money, or borrow it directly from the Federal Reserve, which would rebate the interest. And then if you borrow it for infrastructure, it's probably your best investment ever, borrow it for infrastructure, and the infrastructure will pay back the loans. So the money will come back. You can't holler about hyperinflation because it's just like any bank making a loan. You make the loan, the infrastructure pays for itself, the money comes back, pays the loan off. That's basically what Roosevelt did in the 30s, and it worked very well with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation.
For some reason, Trump, a businessman, super rich, feels that anything government can do, business does better, so let it. So he wants to privatize everything instead of using federally created credit to move along his infrastructure program or other things he has in mind. He wants to privatize and let business take over these things and make a profit. But they can still make a profit if you did it by government-issued credit. You know, maybe it wouldn't be as direct. It would be a little bit of a direct way of doing it, but it would create a much healthier economy, which he will not create. His tax cuts that he wants for business will do practically nothing to create jobs. You know, companies will use it for whatever they want to use it for, you know, buying back stock and buying up competitors. And the only time they create jobs is when business is growing and they need more people to do more things. And that certainly is not the case now. The economy is just kind of bumping along. 2% growth. Maybe it'll drop even lower than that. Very, very low growth. And the things that he's proposing will not hype the economy to do better. So what he's saying will happen will not happen. He should know, but he's a businessman. He's got intelligent people around him, but they're telling him the wrong things.
Well, hopefully when this solution two fails, it seems to me we have populist uprisings all around the world. I saw where Jeremy Corbyn has rock star status there in England, and it's not because he's a great speaker. It's because of his ideas. The people, and particularly the young people, are fed up, and Corbyn is promising really radical socialist things. He's going to renationalize the postal system and renationalize the trains and put money back into the medical system so that their national health service is what it once was. And that's very popular. So maybe, arguably, we could do that here. Of course, we need a populist leader. We had one in Bernie Sanders, but the establishment managed to beat him out.
The deep state, deep system. If they wanted to defeat Trump, they never should have nominated Hillary. They should have nominated Sanders because he would have won. But at the same time, the elections are so easily rigged. We've got the UK election coming up next month. I haven't been following the polls, but I think Theresa May is way ahead in the polls. But if it was a close race, it could easily be rigged to have her win to prevent Corbyn from becoming prime minister, the same thing that happened in France. I think Macron would have won anyway, but I think there was a lot of shenanigans going on to be sure that Le Pen had no chance of winning.
Well, apparently the reason Brexit passed was that they counted the vote by hand. They didn't do it electronically, so they couldn't rig it like they can here.
Well, of course, they could always dump ballots that they don't like. even in a hand count.
So you wrote in your article, you concluded, the only responsible solution in Greece, elsewhere in Europe and America is nonviolent revolution. Nothing else can work. So what are you thinking of? Like, what's your proposed solution?
Change never comes from the top down, Ellen. I think we both know that. And voting really is a waste of time. We've got what I call a duopoly system, a one-party state with two right wings. Rhetorically they sound different, but I think in the back rooms they mostly agree with each other. They publicly sound different because they want to be in power rather than the other guy, but they end up taking turns, and that's the way the system works. Independents have no chance whatsoever, and so no matter who you vote for, it's always going to come out the same way. You get new faces, or another phrase I like to use is everything changes but stays the same each election cycle. So you've got to have a different way of changing things. America wasn't created to be a democracy. We need a revolution from the ground up. We need a people's revolution to come up with a new system, because nothing will ever change by going to the ballot box. And we keep seeing, and there is so financially and economically, we see what's happening, Ellen. The rich in business keep getting richer and more powerful, and ordinary people keep losing out. Social America is disappearing incrementally. And I think the day is coming when it simply won't exist anymore.
Well, I've been writing about an alternative currency system that we could use for our populist revolution.
If we had public banking, Ellen, I think it would change everything. You and I are absolutely in sync on that. We need a public banking system. I wish people understood that they don't. Ordinary people have no idea. They have no idea about the difference between public banking, private banking. All they know is banking. You know, they have a bank account. That's all they know. They don't think about who owns it, who controls it, what's going on. They have no idea what the Federal Reserve is all about. I think maybe some growing numbers do, but probably the Federal Reserve Act, 1912, was absolutely the most destructive legislation in the history of the country. Absolutely, just destroyed everything. And even Woodrow Wilson admitted after he signed it into law. I mean, the guy was no dummy. He was a college professor. He knew exactly what he was doing, but he still signed this thing into law. The whole thing done in the middle of the night around Christmas time.
Right.
You remember that story, Ellen?
Yeah.
With a lot of people in Congress away, but just whisked the thing through. Now, anybody who's for ending the Federal Reserve System is targeted for elimination. You want to get yourself assassinated, support getting rid of the Fed with really launching a campaign that starts having legs, and you won't be on this earth very long.
Yeah, well, I saw the Trump administration or Trump faction are suspicious of the Fed, and we're going to look into it, but see how far that goes.
Oh, not with Goldman Sachs running economic and financial policy, Ellen.
Yeah, well, that's it. It'll probably get nipped in the bud as well. Well, it does seem to me it's that the first key is education. We actually have quite a rousing group here that the first key is to understand, it seems to me, that banks, not governments, create our money system, and then they create the money and then they rent it to us. There's this huge drain from the productive economy into the financial economy, and we could fix that, and particularly with new developments like blockchain and smart contracts and smartphones, where you can pay by smartphone with your smart contract on a blockchain, it would be possible to totally bypass the banks.
We could do it, and it's such a great opportunity today because now anybody can find out important, vital information by simply going online and forgetting about watching television or reading the morning paper, which is the way to know absolutely nothing. And most people are still addicted to that way of getting news and information. I think polls show that most people don't trust the media, so why do they waste their time watching it if they don't trust it? But with the internet, it certainly is a way to change the system. It all starts with education, as you say, Ellen. You got to understand what's wrong and what's right, and then it takes activism to initiate change. But even then, if things move too much in the right direction, I wrote an article a couple of days ago that in Britain, Theresa May is supporting government control of the internet. The Tory government is for this, and apparently this is going to become the law of the land, so that anything that the government does not want to published, they can simply pull it off the internet and not allow it to be published, suppress it. So information control even online, and if it's going to happen in Britain, it could happen elsewhere in Europe, it could happen in America. So if we get too powerful in moving ahead toward the right things, they could simply snuff us out by controlling the internet and preventing websites like yours, Ellen, and my site from even being there. And if we try to get information circulated to people, they can find other ways to get rid of us. It's a terrible situation.
Yeah, terrible. And what do they censor? It's fake news. One person's fake news is another person's legitimate news. That's the whole point of being able to do your own research and educate yourself. You just have to go with what resonates with you and sounds true to you, and things resonate differently with different people, but that's how science evolves. That's how knowledge evolves.
Oh, absolutely. My own university honored me, sort of, Ellen. The Harvard University Library came out with a guide to fake news sites, and they included me on it. I'm sure not looking me up to see that I'm an alumnus, but they included me on it. I considered it. I wrote an article about it, and I sent it to the Harvard Library, so now they know who I am for real. I did not get a response. I never give up hope. One of the things that inspires me for what I do now, Ellen, is I really believe that ordinary people can change things if they really become committed to seeking them and wanting them. But, you know, you have to do something about it. You have to get active. And I'm always impressed when I see Europeans much more active than Americans. The age of U.S. protests seemed to die with the Vietnam era. The Occupy Wall Street movement faded too fast. It was wonderful. I wrote so much about it while it was going on, but it was savagely attacked. It just simply faded away. But these are the kind of initiatives we need, nonviolent, but going after the right thing, the right policies that help ordinary people. I think anything is possible to change for the better if enough people get behind them and refuse to quit. That's the way change comes.
Agreed. And I think that the Occupy movement was successful in exposing who the culprit is here, pointing fingers not at each other, which is a classic technique for deflecting attention from where the real villains are, is to have the people fight with each other. So we all focused on Wall Street. And now, like in this Bernie Sanders Brigade event, people were saying that public banking was the natural sequel, like the Occupy movement focused on the problem, but they didn't actually have a solution. And the Bernie Sanders Brigade people are particularly interested in divesting. I'm really struck by how young people are so moral. I mean, they actually want to do the right thing, whereas it seems to me our generation tends to say, well, okay, it's, you know, we're polluting or whatever, but what can we do? It makes money and we have to go along with the system. But the young people really want to do the right thing. So they want to divest from Wells Fargo, for example, for being caught in these massive frauds. But where do you divest to? If you pull your money, if they don't have an alternative, so public banking is the natural follow-on, that we have to set up our own banks, our own big banks that are capitalized, but with the government's own funds, and it gets own liquidity from its own funds. In other words, it moves its deposits out of Wall Street, puts them in its own bank, and moves its capital out of Wall Street, and then it can leverage that capital into credit for the local community.
Absolutely, Ellen, and I think if change ever will come, young people will lead it. And just think of what they're enduring. So many of them are dead and trapped from paying college tuition, and the way the law is written, they cannot default. They can come after your wages, they come after your Social Security if you're still indebted by the time you retire. It's just a terrible system, and they get a college education, and there aren't even decent jobs for most of these people. And the unemployment rate in the country, I imagine, affects young people probably more than any other group. They've got a college education to get decent jobs and have a decent career, and they end up having nothing, working as a low-wage service workers. That's not why they go to college for. Certainly wasn't the case when you and I were in college. So they have a right to be angrier than most other people. You're right about older people. They're set in their ways, but if change is ever going to come, it's going to come from the youths in America that are very, very upset. And with real unemployment in the country, nearly 25%, not the phony 4.4%, and so many of those young people, they have a reason to be very angry.
Right, and it really is enslavement by debt. I remember a banker's memo circulated in the 1860s during the Civil War. It was from Britain, but it said something like, you know, the Americans have this Civil War where slavery was an issue, and that the bankers really weren't opposed to freeing the slaves, because if you had slaves, you had to pay for them, and they were property, and you had to take care of them and worry about their health and so forth. But if you could enslave them by debt, then they have to pay their own housing and their own health. And
it's a different form of slavery. Also, the fact that people are so underpaid now, poverty wages, so you've got wage slavery on top of it.
Right. Well,
Ellen, I've got to say one thing. Aside from what we're talking about, I would advise everybody listening to your program, if they only chose two books in the next year or 2 years or 5 years to read, absolutely read Ellen's Web of Debt and the Public Banking Solution, and you will understand how the whole system works and how it can be fixed. Those are the two books I would suggest to people. I would urge people, above all, to read those books. Ellen, you did such a phenomenal job in both, and in Web of Debt, I never wrote so much about one book as I did about Web of Debt. I was so entranced by it, I simply could not stop writing about it.
Well, thanks. It's so great to talk to you, and good luck in all your ventures. I'm really glad to hear you're back and in fighting trim.
Thanks, Ellen.
I've been speaking with Stephen Lenman, a prolific writer and syndicated columnist, and someone with keen insight on what's going on today.
If you're paying attention at all to the discussions of money in Washington, you're aware that infrastructure is the hot new frontier for investors the world over who are anxious to get their hands on public assets and to get them cheap. The global banking cartel has demonstrated repeatedly in recent years how they go about leveraging control of these valuable assets by, in many cases, impoverishing the states or the cities that own them through frequently egregious lending practices. The new Trump administration seems to want to play along with that agenda by enabling new public-private partnerships that will lend private dollars for infrastructure projects, paying sizable profits to private interests, which could otherwise be financed by our own public banking institutions, if we had them. Donald Cohen is the executive director of In the Public Interest, and he's been following these developments closely.
Well, the trend, without consideration of the new president, is, you know, there's a great need to invest in infrastructure, both fixing what we got, building what we make our infrastructure better and more modern and all that. You know, the challenge has always been the simple truth that things that we want and need and value cost money. And so we've got a president who claims he wants to build infrastructure, but doesn't want to raise, but wants not only does he not want to raise taxes or revenues to pay for it, he actually wants to cut taxes. And you've got a House of Representatives and a Senate that doesn't want to spend money either and doesn't want to raise taxes. So we're sort of in a bad spot in terms of actually solving the problem. I mean, it's investing in things that we need, water systems, roads, and transit systems, and all that. What the administration is saying, there's no plan yet, but what the administration is saying is that what we're going to do is we're going to give tax credits and try to find other ways to actually stimulate, you know, investment, but the majority of that's going to be in private investment. And what they're talking about is something actually they're calling recycling assets, which fundamentally means selling off, and, you know, which could just mean a very long-term lease, but selling off a road or bridge or a set of parking meters like they did in Chicago, taking that cash and investing it in new infrastructure. That's kind of their latest idea. And so essentially the only way, you know, if you listen to what they say, you know, the path that they're driving towards is handing off American infrastructure to private investors and operators to control and profit from.
In huge volumes, it seems that they've got their targets on every community, city, state, and across the nation. You know, Ellen Brown talks about alternatives being much more progressive and creative in that we could fund ourselves through government issuance of money the way Roosevelt did and Lincoln did and the way we're entitled to. Do you see any hope for that kind of a tactic or that kind of a strategy?
Well, one thing to remember is that, a couple of things to remember. One is that, you know, the federal government doesn't actually build things for the most part. States do, cities do, water districts do. And if you look at actually what happened, even just in the November election around the country, several hundred billion dollars of tax-exempt municipal bond measures passed, paid for by taxes or, you know, assessments on property or what have you. Two, to do transit, there were water bonds, there were housing bonds. So, in fact, that actually is already happening. You know, America is, for the most part, financing its infrastructure without the federal government's help right now by taxing local residents and state residents, and paying back that money on very cheap, you know, low-interest loans. Now, they're not funding it. They're not paying for it. They're actually still borrowing the money, but they're borrowing it real cheap.
And the tax bonds, the tax advantages that are given to these people are really a subsidy for private business, isn't it?
Well, it's a subsidy. To mention that, too, it's a subsidy for people who invest in bonds. And there are lots of people with 401ks who have, you know, who have bond funds, like I do, actually. So, but right. I couldn't tell you what the percentages are, so I think it, but it's absolutely a subsidy. And so it kind of gets back to the basic truth. Things cost money. So the only question is how we're going to pay for it, right? And that's really the only thing the federal government has to offer. So they could either subsidize it through the tax exemption of municipal bonds. They could fund it directly by, you know, through raising revenues and general funds. They can give out a, you know, low-interest loans. They could give grants. They could give tax credits, a particularly dumb idea. But that's all the federal government can do. In fact, we actually do need to use the word subsidy. We actually need to pay for it. And so the only question is how.
Of course, the dynamic of having a bank being able to issue the credit from the bank is the strategy that we would propose.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem to be something that the state or the government is willing to employ because they are always borrowing their money from private sources.
I think you're right. I mean, we would agree. I mean, having a public bank would be, you know, obviously the far, far superior solution. I just had the opportunity to listen to the other day to one of Trump's key advisors, Richard Lefrak, who's a well-known developer in New York, who said to a group of his friends, actually, it would be a good idea to have an infrastructure bank, just don't call it that, because this is pure politics, because the Republicans in Congress, they think it's bureaucracy, they don't want more government. While it's a good idea, you know, you got to fool the Republicans to get convinced that it isn't big government.
Well, that's interesting because the infrastructure banks, so-called banks, like in California, for example, but also around the country, are really not banks at all. They're revolving funds. And I know that one of the ideas is to turn them actually into depository banks where the power of banking to leverage capital a tenfold, nominally tenfold, would dramatically change the profile of how we solve our problems. And so we would go from becoming a supplicant to from the private capital industry to providers of our own capital. But that is kind of a good news message that no one wants to let out of the bag, because they've got this this huge marketplace and overflowing basket of profits that they're looking targeting in infrastructure.
And they're sitting on the end of 40 years of strategic attack on the very idea of public institutions and government. And so they're using that, you know, as a basis to attack all any idea that would smell at all of government involvement. What they've done over the last 40 years, conservatives, you know, who are both, they are both ideological conservatives who really don't believe in government, and then there's also those that simply want the prize, that want to profit off the trillions of dollars we've spent every year. You know, you add that up together, they've had a great deal of success in turning the American people away from the idea that public institutions and public solutions are in fact cheaper, better, more flexible, and, you know, and more democratic.
Yeah, this is a point that you made the last time we spoke on this program about the Powell memo that came out in the 70s, which moved public thinking and really the, you know, the memes that circulated in the last several decades about incompetence of public administration. And yet what we're seeing around the world is quite the opposite, isn't it? In England, for example, and in Germany, you point out in this wonderful weekly review of privatization newsletter that the Germans and the English want to move the other way. Not all the English at this point. It's a little premature. They've got an election coming up, but they want to take back some of that control from private hands.
Yeah, well, I keep repeating myself, but, you know, at some point, truth actually sort of pokes its head. And the truth here is that public spending, and public, whether you borrow it or public bank or whether you borrow it tax-exempt municipal debt, is just a hell of a lot cheaper. And so why borrow money on 3% versus you could borrow money on 15%? Ideology should not make you want to pay that much more, number one. And then two, I think what lots of folks have found is that when you hand over control for the road for 40 years, 50 years, you actually lose the ability to do things that matter to the public. And so it just doesn't make sense.
The ideological drive to take things over is the setup by not investing in infrastructure and letting it fail, creating a crisis of funding, and then, oh, they're here with the solution, here, borrow some money from us, is the kind of an international setup that we're seeing by the big banks in countries around the world, not the least of which is Greece and Puerto Rico and Argentina and all of that. Are you seeing any sort of a new awareness, a new level of awareness around this scam, this agenda?
It's hard to say. It's hard to really gauge where the public is on substantive issues these days because we're in a post-fact world. I mean, I think you and I have never experienced anything quite like this. I do think there's a lot of concern about the takeover of America. So I think it feels like there's a generalized concern, but I think the issue of infrastructure is still pretty far away and pretty abstract. And so that's our task, is to say, no, it's not infrastructure. It's your road. It's your bridge. It's your water system. It's your transit system. We got to pay for them. We can do it better. And in fact, it would make your life better and it would make the economy better.
You know, I noticed that the airline industry, as you point out in your newsletter on privatization, that they're pushing hard to get Congress to adopt the president's budget proposal to privatize the public air traffic control system. That's very much like what Ronald Reagan did which kind of began this whole process when he came in and got the air traffic controllers out of the unions and kind of disempowered that group. What would happen? What would it look like for the privatized air traffic control system in your sense?
Well, it would. Canada has either partially or wholly privatized system, I believe, but they have a set of laws that regulate and both labor standards and other kind of safety standards and all that. We don't have that kind of stuff here. I mean, what it would look like is the airlines would create, I assume they would create a consortium. They would pay for it. They would control it. There would be some sort of federal oversight of that, which is always troubling because, you know, to count on that mechanism. because right now the Trump administration and all the cabinet officers are, you know, slowly but surely, you know, dismantling the oversight ability and the enforcement ability of rules and regulations of each of the departments. So you would have a private company. They might even, you know, form it as a nonprofit. Who knows? But it would be completely owned and controlled and paid for by the airlines. And I can't predict exactly, but I think what you're seeing in air traffic right now is there's a whole new shift that's gone on given the consolidation in the airline industry. In fact, even down to the level of the bonuses to the CEOs, which are really the fundamental incentives for the industry, they are now about stock price, profit, and cost savings, when they used to be about, you know, customer service, on-time arrivals, lost baggage, customer complaints. That's actually how they used to measure CEOs and whether they are doing a good job or not. Now it's purely on cost. And I fly a fair amount. I see that every day.
Yeah. So the financialization of our services and of our industries has driven that trend away from actually delivering results.
When you shift the power dynamic of who has power, either legislatively or legally, towards, you know, the finance industry or private interests, you know, the public always loses, and, you know, that's fundamentally what's going on there.
So what do we need to do, Donald? What can American citizens do to step into this process? Is this something they can look at locally?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, I think everyone understands that pressuring Congress and letting them know what's, you know, what matters these days is critically important. But like I was saying earlier, infrastructure happens on the ground, happens in real places. And, you know, mayors and governors like to build things. And so, and in fact, that's where all the decisions are made. Now, they may be supercharged and incentivized by a federal grant or a loan or a credit, but it's all local. We think things need to be built. You know, we're not against building things that we need. We're for that. But people should be looking at, you know, what's going to be happening in their town. What are they thinking about rebuilding? Is it the water system needs to be upgraded or a new transit line or what have you? And start paying attention to the process by which that happens and weighing in to say, you know, there's a better way to do this if you're thinking about doing it through a public-private partnership or handing it over long periods of time. And, you know, we have some things on our website, some questions to ask documents on infrastructure and other sectors that really help people. It's actually pretty complicated to figure out how to get the money and pay for some, you know, a road or a bridge or a transit system. And so everyone doesn't need to become an expert in that, but they do need to know what questions to ask so that the experts answer them in the right way. And we found that to be pretty effective.
And they can get these resources and direction and support from your website, which is inthepublicinterest.org, correct?
That's right.
And there I would just want to suggest and thank you again for coming up with this weekly newsletter on privatization. It's really quite troubling, shocking, but also very important as a bit of insight into what's going on underneath the surface of our government administration and who's got the hands on the levers that we should be getting our hands on. Donald, thank you so much for taking the time.
You're welcome. It's great to talk to you as always.
That's Donald Cohen, Executive Director of In the Public Interest. More information and subscription for that weekly newsletter on privatization is available from their website, inthepublicinterest.org. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.